Nick DiGilio here. How you doing, everybody? We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and it is a Monday morning, which means we do the box office and the movie reviews. Colin Suter, Eric Childress are joining me. And they took a week off because last week was the Chicago Critics Film Festival at the Music Box, and we are going to recap that. Talk about this weekend's box office, review the new movies, and actually Eric has done a summer box office prediction because he's Nostradamus, and we'll get to that as well. So let's get the guys on the air. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
And Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
All righty then. How are you guys?
Good.
All right.
Recovering.
Yeah. So I understand it went very, very well. The third annual Chicago Critics Film Festival at the Music Box this past week.
Yeah. All done. All good. We were very, very happy with how things turned out throughout the week. Success for the third year in a row and still growing.
Well, tell me about some of the things that happened over that the past week.
Oh boy, where to begin? Well, we had on Saturday was quite a day. Actually, we had Kobe Smulders was there for two screenings, and what a delight she was. She couldn't have been cooler and funnier and more gracious to be there. She hung out and took pictures and signed autographs with literally everybody who stuck around after the screenings. She was just there for everybody. And then after Kobe left, we had both Bobcat Goldthwait and Barry Crimmins there,
right,
for their screening. And once again, the both of them hung around for quite some time after the screening and talked with people, had some big conversations with people based on the subject matter of their film. Which ended up winning the Audience Award.
Wow! Okay, cool.
Yeah, it was one of our highest rated films that we've had. We've only been doing the Audience Award now for 2 years, but Bobcat ended up winning this year, and they've been sort of praising our festival just to the hilt, and Bobcat has been very humbled the last couple of years. Coming here, and they said that our fest is one of the favorites that they've gone to through all these years.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so we're really happy that that they ended up winning. And then there were so many things during the week, and Colin's shorts program went really well.
Yeah, Colin, let's talk about that. How'd the shorts program go? How did Ryan Oliver's movie go across?
Oh, Ryan Oliver's movie did great. That was probably the most well-attended shorts thing I've ever done. And it was a very enthusiastic midnight crowd. You know, this was kind of an experiment that we did this year, was doing a round of short films at midnight instead of a movie at midnight. And it was in large part because of Ryan Oliver's film, which is, 46 minutes long, which is hard to program anything, a movie that's 46 minutes long.
Right.
So I put a few more shorts for it, and it went over great. I mean, the audience was really into all the movies, not just Ryan's, but all of them. So it turned out to be pretty successful. And then the second shorts program that I did on Sunday, I actually had a filmmaker show up for it, which was pretty cool. The one I was talking about a couple weeks ago about the crazy landlady who never stops calling.
Oh, right.
So a movie called One Year Lease is really funny. And then on Monday, it was lightly attended, 5 p.m. on a Monday, but I decided to add another short film to it, Don Hertzfeld's World of Tomorrow, which I talked about last week, which is a favorite movie at our festival. I thought, if you're coming out to a shorts program at 5 p.m. on a Monday, you deserve to see a masterpiece. So I decided to throw that on there at the end, and everyone was happy about that. So, and I was very happy about Bobcat Goldthwait winning because it was an unexpected winner for us. I mean, none of us could have predicted that. There's a couple other films that were, obvious choices, our closing night film being one of them. But no, it was having Bobcat Goldthwait win the audience award, it was like, okay, the audience is really like really telling us what they love, you know.
That's very cool.
Not just you know, playing it safe or whatever, or, you know, giving us an obvious score.
Was the overall attendance larger? Has it increased over the 3 years?
Yes, it has. We beat last year's attendance, especially like during the week. Like all of our like weekday numbers were up from last year, which was quite a thing. I mean, we had a few more guests and whatnot, but you know, our biggest guest day was Saturday with Kobe and Bobcat, and then Wednesday night we had Joan Cusack was there with James Ponsell for the end of the tour. Which I finally caught up with. It was such a fantastic film. Mm-hmm. And then Adam Pally was there for the Wednesday night film, which we were kind of hoping it was going to be better attended. But even Adam Pally and the director were joking, like, we screened this movie for two people before. So they were just – all the guests there were just so sort of just gracious to play the Music Box Theater. There were so many were just commenting, like, they didn't even – care that, you know, the attendance was not, you know, it wasn't a packed house.
Right.
They just loved the fact that they were the opportunity to play that theater. So
I think even Ryan Oliver commented in his Q&A that, you know, having Restoration play at the Music Box is like having a movie play at Madison Square Garden. So
no, it's true. It's true. It's amazing. Now, I have not been to the Music Box, in a while, and I understand that they have, like, changed a lot of stuff and expanded.
Yeah, I mean, they completely redid the lobby. The whole left side of the lobby now is basically your concession area. So there's a bit more room there. And then they bought this space next door which they've converted into this really great lounge and bar area that you can hang out, you know, before and after the movies. That's
wow.
Where a lot of the guests end up going after their films and just sort of hanging and just chatting with people. It's something that, you know, you don't really get at a lot of these other film festivals. And granted, we've been lucky to have guests that are willing to do that. But they, you know, they just come and they hang out and they were signing stuff and taking pictures and chatting about the movies and stuff. And we're hoping to sort of utilize that space to even greater effect next year.
Well, that's great. Congratulations, you guys. I know it was a lot of work, a lot of hard work, and I'm glad it was a success. And you're planning on doing it again next year.
Yeah, believe it or not, we're crazy enough to do it again.
Okay. All right, cool.
Keep getting away with it, so, you know, we're doing it so we can't get away with it anymore.
Well, that's great, man. All right, let's talk about the box office for this weekend. Let's take a look at the 3 day box office returns right here. Number one, The Avengers: Age of Ultron with 77.2 million over the weekend. That's a pretty big take for a second week.
Yeah, second biggest second weekend take ever. So yeah, pretty big.
Wow. And it's up to 312 million total. Number two, Hot Pursuit with 13.3 million, which is what would be predicted for that one?
Well, some people were predicting higher for that one based on the advertising, and some people seem to think Reese Witherspoon's comedies do very well. I was predicting more like 14, 15, so it wasn't that much of a shock to me, but a lot of people are already declaring it a kind of a bomb. So
wow. Okay. Number three, The Age of Adeline, $5.6 million, bringing its total up to $31.5 million. I'm shocked that it's made that amount of money.
Yeah, there's not much else to see. So it's, you know, people are kind of just catching on to that one.
Yeah. Number four, Furious 7, $5.2 million, bringing its total up to $338.4 million. And again, worldwide, over a billion.
$1.466 billion. Fourth highest ever.
I don't know. I mean, I just find that.
You should.
I find that hilarious. I you know.
And it's actually grossed, what, you said $338 million here in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's grossed $388 million in China. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. and then number five is Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, $5.1 million. Wow, what a drop from the first one, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Paul.
They opened the first one in January when, you know, I guess, you know, the people were ripe for a bit of silliness like that, and it just kind of caught on. I mean, Kevin James has not exactly maintained his status as some sort of comedic leading man since then.
He's been a part of those ensemble, idiotic Sandler movies.
Correct, correct.
But outside, what was the one with Salma Hayek where he's punching people? What the hell?
Here Comes the Boom.
Right, yeah. Now, that did not do well, right?
No, no. Okay. Right. In fact, the only time anyone's even thought about that since that movie came out was on Inside Amy Schumer this week.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay, we got a break, okay, guys?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so hang on. We'll take a break, and we've got Eric, we've got Colin, and we've got more movie reviews coming up. And we will also look more at the box office. And Eric has some summer box office predictions that we will take a look at as well right here on 720 WGN. It's Nick DiGilio. Good morning, everybody. It's a Monday morning, which means we do movie reviews, box office, and more. And later on, my dad calls in and tells a joke, because it's a jokey, 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 jokey time. Colin Suter, Eric Childress, fresh from the success of the Chicago Critics Film Festival, are discussing the box office with me, and then we'll review the new movies. And we welcome Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
And Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of money that the Avengers is making. Is this what was predicted?
No, it's not. I mean, it's one of those double-edged swords where, you know, when you start talking about, like, the second highest first weekend and second highest second weekend of ever, I mean, those are pretty hefty numbers. But at the same time, you're also comparing it directly to the first film. And the predictions for the first weekend were much higher than they were. There were some people that were predicting upwards of 240, some even crazy enough to say over 300 million. Some people thought it was going to make last weekend. So when you predict numbers that high and it ends up with like 188, all of a sudden the movie is labeled some sort of disappointment. But you know, you look at the numbers this week, and granted, you know, the numbers are still very high because, you know, they started very high. But, you know, the first movie, you know, when you do $207 million the first time around and in the second week you only drop 50%, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Actually. And, you know, this one dropped 60%. So the word of mouth is not quite where it was. I mean, the first film didn't really have any competition that second weekend, and this weekend's only new competition was the Reese Witherspoon movie. So 60% in the second weekend, you know, the writing is, you know, kind of out there.
Wow. Interesting. Really interesting. You know, let's actually review them. Let's actually talk about the Avengers, since you guys weren't on last week. And the Avengers Age of Ultron came out. We weren't able to actually officially review it. So we're in the middle of the box office, and we'll do a little bit more box office analysis coming up. And again, Eric, I want to talk about your summer box office prediction. That's all coming up as well. But let's review Age of Ultron. Colin, give us the rundown about Age of Ultron.
Okay, so the Avengers are back. You all know who they are, what their backstory is. So now they can just go off and battle big mechanical-looking bad guys who are hell-bent on taking over planet Earth, and we don't have to, you know, go through all, you know, origin story kind of thing. And that's where the movie just drops us right in the middle of an action sequence. The bad guy, in this case, is Ultron. Who wants, like I said, big mechanical looking guy, who wants to, you know, take over the planet. He has a couple of minions to try and help him, and they come in the form of other sort of super. superhero Avengers.
And he's created by Tony Stark. He was created by Tony
Stark. Right, that's right. Created by Tony Stark. Sorry, it's been a couple weeks and a few.
Yeah, no, I understand. I understand. I understand.
Yeah. So anyway, so he's got two minions. One played by one's called the Scarlet Witch, played by Elizabeth Olsen. The other one's called Quicksilver, played by Kevin Bacon. Sorry, Aaron Taylor Johnson. bad joke. Sorry.
Okay.
Ultron was designed to find threats to the world and destroy them, but this Ultron has artificial intelligence, and he's concocted a different plan for his planet. On the Avengers side of the story, there's a little bit of a sort of a romantic subplot or complication involving Black Widow and the Hulk. There's a ton of supporting characters, one of whom, of course, is played by Cobie Smulders. They all come in to try and help expand this universe that is already cluttered and really big. So I review this, of course, with a tone of sarcasm, mainly because it's a superhero movie, and that's just kind of how I am these days. But I just want everyone to know, the Avengers, I love the first Avengers movie. It's on my top list. Pretty sure it was on Eric's, too. This is a rare instance where I'm coming into a superhero movie rather excited. Joss Whedon is, at home on this one, too. And that Whedon spark is definitely there in the dialogue. I mean, that is not lost at all. And I understand when you make these movies, you got to make them bigger. You got to, bring in a few more characters. But, man, this thing is just overstuffed. So much so that I just kind of lost the thread after a while and realized there's no threat here. It's when you got 9 or 10 or 11 Avengers, and they all have their own thing going during the final hour of the film. It's just kind of to be a little bit of a drag to sit through, going, look, I know how this is going to come out. Let's just get to it. It's just something a little bit off about this film. Some of the dialogue is really clever and funny in that Joss way. Some of the action sequences are pretty good. It's kind of hard to screw some of these things up. It just gets to be a bit of a drag after a while. And you just sort of realize that there's something, the heart is missing or too much studio meddling, as I understand it. It just kind of, makes the thing go, man, now I'm not looking forward to the third one because now there's 10 or 11 characters that are going to be in this thing, all helping to fight whatever evil person is trying to take over the world.
Yeah, because at the end of the movie there are now like 15 Avengers.
I'm just not down with that anymore. I would have preferred let's kill one of the Avengers off and show that some of these guys really are threats to the whole thing. Let's have maybe 4 or 5 Avengers for the next one. I'm back to being, my usual cynical self when it comes to superhero movies. I thought this movie would, kind of bring me out of that. This one just didn't do for me.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Wait until Colin sees the cast list for the next Captain America movie.
it just keeps growing. There's like an you're cast in it. Did you say?
Yeah, I'm in it.
No, but it just like every time I go to IMDb, there's like a new update on who's in the new Captain America movie.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It is pretty crazy. Colin, has certainly hit on something, with this movie. And when I, even before some of the stories are coming out of that Whedon was clearly had some clashing with Marvel, that's precisely what I said coming out of this movie. Like this movie feels like it has the same problems that both like Iron Man 2 and Spider-Man 3 did in that it's clearly not the clear director's vision. There's a lot of things in here that are just bouncing into one another and just, half-baked ideas and half-baked plots and half-baked characters. And, you know, Colin, you know, talked about, you know, sort of there's no real threat here. And that's, you know, because Ultron is just not that good of a villain. Ultron is never as frightening in this movie as he is in his first appearance, when he's this sort of this clunky, half-put-together robot that's bleeding fluid and, you know, talking really menacingly. You know, and then eventually you get to a point where, you know, he's just this a transformer who is, you know, doing, you know, bebopping and scatting and doing one-liners later on in the movie. And the fact that he's voiced by James Spader is, you know, you know, I mean, if you know the Seinfeld episode.
Well, it takes me right back to Less Than Zero.
Well, certainly. Well, certainly. Julian is dead, but never mind. But, yeah, no, I mean, there's a huge problem with just the way this movie is constructed, and there are things in the movie that just never seem fully fleshed out. And the thing about the first Avengers, why that film worked so well, because first of all, you had all these characters coming together for the first time, so it's kind of cool to sort of, you know, put them in the same space. But the way Whedon concocted that story was that there was, when you get to the half hour climax, where, you know, essentially the Avengers are just, you know, they're fighting off kind of a, you know, anonymous, you know, these anonymous creatures from this other dimension,
yeah,
that doesn't really mean anything. The joy in that is not just how, you know, wonderful the action sequence is actually put together, but here you have the culmination of them finally fighting together for the first time, putting aside their differences and their different personalities, and just the joy of them working together is what makes the ending of that movie work so well. When you get to the ending of this movie, and you have essentially kind of a similar, you know, idea, you just all these anonymous robots crashing into one another, it's just not, you don't, that same feeling of fun and discovery is just not there anymore. So you end up, you just kind of watch, you might as well be watching another Transformers movie by the end of this thing. And it's just not, it's not as clever, it's not as funny. You can clearly tell that Marvel was meddling with this thing, and there's a reason why Joss Whedon is not going to do the third one, because he clearly had enough. Yeah. And I kind of did too, and I think this is certainly one of the weaker Marvel films that they put out.
Yeah, I actually thought it sucked.
I actually thought it sucked.
And it, to me, we have not touched upon this. It's 9.5 hours long. I mean, it's
actually shorter than the first movie.
Is it shorter than the first movie?
Because
it felt like it was 10 hours long. I just didn't care what was happening. I thought so much of it was forced. I thought the action sequences were, if you were to tell me that the same guy directed the first Avengers movie, I'd say no. To me, the action sequences were a lot more cluttered and more chaotic. I didn't think it was nearly as clever. I didn't care. I mean, I thought the villain was boring. I thought Ultron was completely boring. Loki was so much cooler. And Hulk slamming Loki around. I mean, I needed to see that. And, I didn't even know, you know, like it took my great producer, Dan Shagru, to remind me that there was a moment that actually took place between Bruce Banner Black Widow. I know, but what's her actual name? Natasha Romanoff, in the first movie, that they had like a moment together. And I didn't know that. So, like, this romance that they did, I was like, what the hell is this? What is... And then, like, so we have, like, domestic sequences in the movie with Hawkeye? What?
Yeah, that whole sequence is like Whedon, like him doing meta on Hawkeye, because everyone knows or it's said that, you know, Hawkeye is the least interesting character. So what are they going to do? They're going to bring him to a farmhouse and comment on just how uninteresting he really is.
Yeah, but then the thing is, he's got lines that where he acknowledges how uninteresting he is.
Exactly.
You know, like he's got not he's like, I'm just a guy who shoots arrows. You know, it's like, what the hell? What?
Yeah.
I actually thought it was really bad. And I was massively disappointed in it, and I didn't think it was ever going to end. So you guys hang on. We'll come back. Eric, I want you to talk about the your predictions for the summer box office, and then we'll review the new movies, okay?
Okay.
All right, cool. Eric, and Colin are with me, and we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back right after this on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. and then hanging out with the Steve Cochran gang on a Monday morning. My dad will call in later because it's a jokey time. But right now, Colin and Eric are with me to talk about box office and review the new movies. Colin, welcome.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So next week, well, I don't even know what to say about about how excited I am about what's going to happen on Friday. I know you guys are going to see the screening of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, I would hope that you guys would text me as to what you think.
Yeah, we can't wait to see Pitch Perfect 2.
Well, that was the question I have. Pitch Perfect 2 is probably going to make more money than Mad Max, correct?
That's what I think. Some people think I'm nuts, but that's what I believe.
Out of the gate, what do you think, Colin?
It doesn't sound that far-fetched. I mean, Pitch Perfect was a pretty big hit, and, you know, an equally big a hit, or if not a bigger hit, on video and, you know, on cable. I mean, it really, you know, I've seen so many people try to do that cup song and miserably at it, but, man, people love it. And, and you know what? It is a funny movie.
No. Listen, Pitch Perfect, I think Pitch Perfect is a perfectly entertaining movie. I really like Pitch Perfect. I think it's great. In fact, it's my producer, Dan Chagrew, and his wife. It's like their favorite movie ever. They watch it constantly. But the thing, and the other thing about it is that it is a much more straightforward kind of a movie that you're going to see on a weekend than the Mad Max movie. I mean, like, it's like, oh, you want to go out and see a movie? Oh, let's go see Pitch Perfect instead of seeing a bunch of crazy maniacs, you know, flying around in around in cars with shaved heads and, you know, screaming.
And it's a crossover film, too. I mean, you just mentioned Dan and his wife, you know, that it's a movie that is not just for the ladies, that, you know, guys can go and check this thing out and probably will have just as good a time.
Right.
If not, in some cases, more. I know my sister and her husband, you know, her husband thought he was going to hate the movie, and then he saw it once on cable, and then it was on every day, and he watched it like every day.
Well, it is on every day.
It is.
There was a period of time when Pitch Perfect was on like every day on cable.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind it. I mean, I really enjoy it. I think it's a really good movie. So I'm looking forward to it. But I got to tell you, I don't know if I have ever been more excited about a movie in my life than this new damn Mad Max movie. I am losing my mind.
Yeah, and from what I'm hearing, that the first like reviews are going to be released tomorrow morning.
Yeah,
and they're kind of confirm your excitement.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
You know, Nicholas Hoult was on James Corden's show the other night. And they showed a clip, and it was the first clip I've seen from it. Like, I've seen the trailers and stuff, but this was actually the first clip, like a full clip I've seen from the movie. I almost jumped out my window.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say. I'm losing my mind.
When I got to see The Road Warrior on the big screen at the South by Southwest this year, and George Miller was there in attendance.
Oh.
And what a lovely personality this guy is, and he introduced a clip on involving Hardy and Theron and a group of lovingly dressed women, and it was fantastic.
You know, I don't even know. I mean, I showed Road Warrior earlier this year at my movie club, and were you, Colin? You were there, right?
I was there, yeah.
And Eric, were you? You weren't there, were you?
No, I missed it.
Yeah, you know, I don't. That movie is unbelievable, and you know, and I love the third one. I know the third one gets a lot of people, you know, slam on the third one. I like the third one. I think the third one's really good. There's a lot of great stuff in it, and Colin, as you know, you and I have discussed. Whenever anybody says why the third one sucks, and you ask why, and they go the kids.
Yeah,
but then it's a good movie.
It's a really good movie, and that's the thing that goes underappreciated about it, is that it's not a retread sequel, because that George Miller doesn't make retread sequels. You watch that, you watch Babe, Pig in the City, even watch Happy Feet 2. These movies are not phoned-in sequels.
No.
They are movies that expand whatever world they take place in, and, you know, if it's a different tone, it's a different tone.
Yeah.
But you know what? I appreciate that.
No, he's the man. And I believe on Friday when I see the movie, my head will actually explode.
Yeah.
I think my head will actually explode. So, all right, so we got Mad Max 2 coming out, or Mad Max 2. What am I talking about? I'm just looking. Mad Max Fury Road coming out on Friday. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got the movie reviews, the official movie reviews coming up, and right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Yeah, here till 5, and then we'll hang out with the Cochran gang after that. Movie review time. Let's get Colin back in here. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
And hello, Eric.
Hello.
Before we do the movie reviews, Eric, you have made some summer box office predictions.
I have.
Yeah. So you're saying that the Mad Max movie is eventually going to earn about $107 million. So just over $100 million, you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious to see how it's going to open this week against Pitch Perfect. People are sort of thinking in the mid to low 40s for that, which obviously would be very good.
For a little higher than I originally predicted. Mid to low 40s for Mad Max or for Pitch
Mad
Perfect?
Mad Max.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And but they are saying that Pitch Perfect 2 is actually tracking higher than Mad Max, so the math is out there for that as well.
Yeah.
I'm curious, as great as much as we're looking forward to Mad Max, you did hit upon earlier that it, you know, there is kind of a niche thing going on with this. And that the hardcore fans are going to show up, but you're not going to sort of probably get that Furious 7 crowd. Even though this movie is probably going to put all of those movies to shame.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's just, you know, people aren't going to look at it that way. You're selling the brand at this point. You're not exactly selling Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. So you're selling the spectacle, you're selling the brand. And that's why I still think that Pitch Perfect 2 is going to be a real story next week.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I agree with you. Obviously, as much as I'm looking forward to the Mad Max movie, I think Pitch Perfect 2 is going to make more money. I think there's no question about it. It's just the more, widely appealing film.
Yeah.
Poltergeist, $63 million. You don't think it's going to do more than that?
No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, for one, they're not screening it for critics, so that that we know that much going in. So the studio is not very high on the film, Every time people bring it up, Poltergeist is a movie, our generations, this is kind of a seminal horror film of that time, and I think when people hear this name brought up, they're just like, why? As much as any of the remakes that we've had from that era, people are just like, well, it was why? And I don't know if the trailers are doing much for it. The only thing that interests me involved with it is the fact that Gil Keenan, who did Monster House, directed it.
Yeah.
So, that's gotten me curious. But, the fact that it seems like they're not that confident in the movie, I think it's going to, like most horror movies, it's going to probably have a decent opening weekend and then die out pretty quickly.
Well, the trailer is just, it looks like they took, the original Poltergeist, and then they just were like, okay, let's throw some Paranormal Activity stuff in here.
Right.
And have the kid get dragged up the stairs and all that,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not a fan of the, I'm sorry. I know it's sacrilegious.
Yeah.
But I think the original Poltergeist sucks and never scared me. I don't know. As you guys know, I refer to Toby Hooper as Toby Fluker. Because he had the one movie. He had Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's stuff in Life Force that I like.
But, Life Force is a nutty movie.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy, and that's the only other one that I kind of give a pass to. But, man, that in my opinion, Hooper has not directed. Well, the you know what wasn't bad? was the one we saw at the Toolbox Murders.
Yeah, it was okay.
It was okay, and I expected it to completely suck.
Yeah,
but you know, under the conditions that we saw, it were too much fun.
Yeah, and plus everyone knows the Poltergeist is really a Spielberg film anyway.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
that too.
Probably why I hated it. So Tomorrowland, $160 million. You don't think it's going to make more than that?
Well, I mean, it's right in the middle of a lot of things that are going on. You know, with Pitch Perfect 2 and Mad Max, and this is one of those really hard to predict movies. You know, Brad Bird. We all love Brad Bird. I've been trying to avoid the trailers as much as possible now because I want to go in fresh.
Oh, it looks great, man.
Yeah. So I'm wondering
great.
If this is good. I mean, it's Disney released it, and it's obviously there's a tie-in to Disneyland and whatnot.
Right.
But, you know, I'm curious to see if this is going to do the sort of business that, you know, if it's going to be sort of Maleficent for boys the way that, you know, that Maleficent was for girls last year. But, you know, $160 million, that seems a very fair number to hedge my bets with, I think.
Okay. All right. Jurassic World. You're predicting $219 million. That sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I think some people are thinking higher on that one. But, you know, I mean, Jurassic Park 3, you know, did well. But the previews to me, I'm curious to see what the response is going to be. There's already been some negative stuff. People have been talking about the trailers. And I'm curious to see if, you know, I think it's going to open very big, and we'll see what the word of mouth is on it.
When does Ant-Man open?
July 17th.
Okay, so it's you got $147 million for Ant-Man.
Yeah, that's the big anomaly of the summer. I mean, that could. I mean, we saw what Guardians of the Galaxy did last year, and no one guessed it was going to do that much.
Yeah.
And we're going to see. You know, this is the first big Marvel movie after Avengers. Is this going to suffer because of that, or people going to care less about this than some of the other ones? Plus, it's right in the middle of the summer, and you know, I don't like those mid to late July release dates. Those films tend to that's a period when everyone is like, you know, 2.5 months into summer movies, and you know, fatigue sets in a little bit,
right?
You know, and I have a feeling that could happen to Ant-Man. But I root for Paul Rudd.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I hope it does well. And now Pixels, you've got in at $146 million. For people who might not know, what is Pixels?
Well, Pixels, well, I mean, if I just call it the next Adam Sandler movie, that's slightly unfair. But it's basically, for us nostalgia geeks out there, it's basically something happens where all the video game characters and the video game situations of the 1980s basically come to life. It's kind of like a live-action Wreck-It Ralph, in a way,
right.
And where Adam Sandler and Kevin James and Peter Dinklage are fighting, you know, Pac-Man and Centipede, you know, and all these geeky things that we grew up with in the heyday of the 1980s.
Right.
And you know, the preview, it's calling it the next Adam Sandler movie is not entirely fair.
Who directed
it? See this thing. Chris Columbus.
That's right. It is Chris Columbus.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So you got someone who, you know, at least has some connection with, you know, doing fantasy type films. So it's not just one of the Sandler regulars. So, you know, I'm curious. I'm very curious about this one.
Yeah, me too. I saw the trailer for it and I was like, okay, I don't know where I'm going to go on this.
Yeah.
But I like the premise. I'm not crazy about Chris Columbus, though.
No, you shouldn't be.
Yeah. All right. And then I got to tell you, man, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, I can't wait to see this damn movie. $247 million is what you're predicting. That sounds about right. Maybe a little bit more.
Well, it's possible. I think this is a film that, you know, it opens July 31st. I mean, they pushed this thing up 6 months for a reason. It was originally supposed to open in the wake of Star Wars.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was supposed to open at Christmas time, just like Ghost Protocol did. And Ghost Protocol, you know, killed when it came out.
Yeah,
it was a huge, huge success when everyone was sort of thinking that the franchise was kind of dying out and that Cruise's power was kind of dying out. And that movie, everyone, well, you know, if it's a great movie, we'll go see anything with Tom Cruise. So that one did very well. And, you know, normally, you know, moving away from Star Wars is obviously a smart move. But normally studios push movies back.
Right.
They move this thing up 6 months.
Right.
You know, 5 months. So that's a huge sign of confidence in them. The film obviously will be ready by then. And I think it's going to sort of dominate the end of summer the way the Bourne, the last Bourne film did.
Yeah.
Not Legacy, the real Bourne film.
Yeah, yeah, I know. The real Bourne film. Yeah, no, and you know, and Cruz is a lunatic. He's hanging off the side of a damn plane. What the hell is wrong with him?
Well, he's got the special powers from the gods, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I don't know who's insuring that. How much money is the insurance when you make one of these movies with Tom Cruise when he's hanging off the sides of planes?
Yeah, well, I'm just assuming that someone's strong-arming the insurance people.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it looks great. I can't wait to see it. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Come back, we'll review the new movies. Colin and Eric are with me, and we do this every Monday morning. So we will be right back. Nick DiGilio here. Hi, everybody. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m., and then we'll hang out with the Steve Cochran gang afterwards. Colin Suter and Eric Childress are with me. All right, Colin, tell me about Ellie.
All right, about Ellie. This is from Asghar Harhardi, and I'm so sorry if I'm not pronouncing that right, but he's the guy who directed A Separation and The Past.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so this film starts out as kind of a breezy multi-character piece about a group of friends who've known each other since law school who go out to a lake house, such as it is, and you know, hang out for the weekend. One of the characters, Ellie, she's a bit of an outsider, and many wonder why she's even there. She's there to be set up with a single friend in the group. But Ellie is engaged to be married. And this is a bit of a secret as she's trying to break off the engagement. She's been trying to break it off for the past few months. And at this point, this seems to be the storyline of the film when you watch it. But then tragedy strikes. And I'm choosing not to say what the tragedy is, even though it's sort of, I mean, it's shown in the trailer and other reviews do reveal it. It's not a twist, but I did notice in the trailer that one critic is quoted as saying, the less you know going in, the better, which I wholeheartedly agree with. And you got to wonder why they put that quote in the trailer after they just showed you everything. this is a movie that I think, one of the things this guy does so well, this director, I mean, just watching his movies unfold, I think he's just a master storyteller and just how he lets these situations sort of really grow slowly and develop and take you by surprise. And you start to realize that the movie, whatever movie he's making, has so many, deeper implications to it. And, you know, like I often say, I came into this movie pretty cold. So I thought, this is going to be kind of a breezy film for this guy. And then this thing happens and it totally takes you in another journey. And I think that should be savored and experienced. So I'm saying don't go see that. Don't watch the trailer. It's not a big twist. It's just a way of watching a movie that I think should be experienced. This is a movie about betrayal. About the dangers of meddling into people's affairs, no matter how good your intentions may be, and just how far back can you place blame on a situation when something unexpected happens? You know, how far back can you go to sort of, you know, point the finger at somebody as to why this happened or why it shouldn't have happened? And for a while, this movie is like a mystery. This guy, he doesn't use score in his movies. I don't think I've ever heard Asghar Harhardi's movies have a score to it, but there's just this haunting sound of waves crashing against the shore throughout the whole film. That's enough. of an enhancement for a scene. It's a really just a beautiful another home run for this guy, who just makes I think pretty amazing movies. It is kind of like watching a play. You know, you got all these multiple characters in one setting, but he manages to make it feel like it's constricted or that it has to be opened up somehow. The drama is so compelling, and this is definitely one of the best films I've seen this year. It's only playing at the Music Box right now, I think.
Yeah.
It's definitely playing there, but people should definitely go see it.
Okay.
And don't watch the trailer.
Okay, don't watch the trailer. Go see About Ellie. It's playing at the Music Box. Okay. Eric, why don't you tell us about the D-Train?
Okay. D-Train premiered at Sundance this year. It stars Jack Black as the kind of nerdy guy from high school that even the nerds couldn't really stand. He's a guy that kind of rubbed people the wrong way with his organization and just the way he goes about carrying his business. So later in life, he's actually in charge of his high school reunion committee. And he's not getting a lot of response to people showing up. And he wants to make this a big event because it's just the kind of guy he is. So he figures that if he could get the most popular guy in school at the time to come to the reunion, that more people will eventually sign on just for that reason alone. Mm. So based on this sort of flimsy premise, he ends up going to Los Angeles to track down this guy, who's played by James Marsden, who he believes to be a successful actor, when in fact he's just basically known for doing a suntan lotion commercial. But the two of them sort of strike up a friendship that they didn't really have in high school, and he does indeed end up bringing him back and putting him up at his house, and the reunion starts to swell a bit. This movie is kind of a one-joke film in a way, in that there's some things I can't really reveal about the story, but when the movie sort of hits upon this one aspect of the relationship between Jack Black and James Marsden, it then becomes a film where its sort of biggest joke is sort of a recurring double entendre. And that's not exactly the best foundation for a comedy or, a movie that's going to sort of explore the idea of how far you've come since high school. And it's one of Jack Black's most grating performances, one of his most grating characters. He's not a guy that is particularly likable. You can see why people don't like him. He's not particularly rootable even as a lead character interest. James Marsden gives the best performance in the movie. You wish there was more of him. And while the movie, is populated with other, solid comic actors like Catherine Hahn, who's also wasted in the film, it's not very funny. It's not very insightful. You don't really like spending time with these characters, and you don't really care, if they come out all the better by the end of it. So just not a good movie at all, really.
Okay. That's The D Train, which is out now in theaters. Kyle and Eric, hang out, okay?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll come back and we'll finish up the movie reviews right here on 720 WGN. All righty then. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of Trip Tower. Here till 5 a.m., and then we'll hang out with Steve Cochran and the gang afterwards. Movie reviews is what we're in the middle of. It's a Monday morning, so we review the movies. And we bring Colin back and Eric back. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Eric, tell us about Welcome to Me.
Okay. This stars Kristen Wiig as a woman who suffers from some bipolar issues, I guess. And lonely woman lives by herself, who one day ends up winning the big lottery jackpot. And she wins a couple million dollars, more than a couple million dollars.
$86 million.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's not that anyone's counting. But, not realizing what, she could do with her money, The thing that she really wants to do is to be on television. She wants to sort of have her kind of Oprah-like talk show. So if she manages to get a cable access show run by James Marsden and Joan Cusack, amongst others, to put her on television. And she basically pays for the opportunity to do that. Now, she's got no television skills. She doesn't really even have sort of a structure of what her show is actually going to be from time to time. But that sort of loose structure and her trying to be the self-help guru to other people starts to catch on, and she continues to write checks to keep herself on the air, much to the objections of some of the staff people, including one played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, of all people. But you know, she manages to then strike up kind of a little bit of romance with Wes Bentley, who plays Marsden's brother. As she sort of slowly ingratiates herself in this fame, like this overnight fame success that she's having, and you know whether or not it is going to overwhelm her. So here you have another film where you have a woman with or a character with some type of illness that is then going to be sort of espousing her own wisdom upon other people with either similar problems, or people are going to follow this character. You know, this is sort of a premise we've seen over time in movies like Being There and, you know, the Couch Trip and, you know, a number of other movies.
Couch Trip.
There you go. No one's heard of that in a while. Lord. I thought I'd throw the Couch Trip out there. You know, movies like that, you know, that it lends sort of an uneasy quality when you have a character that is clearly not all there, that is not just being exploited, you know, within the confines of the movie, but also sort of for our own entertainment as well. And kudos to Kristen Wiig for juggling this balancing act as best she possibly can. I think the first hour of the film actually works, primarily because of just the way she, you know, she's just so incapable of being unlikable to us. You know, I mean, we've seen her for years now in roles outside of Saturday Night Live, and there's just never a time when we're not sort of on Kristen Wiig's side. She's really funny and charming, even when she's, you know, playing a character that, you know, is kind of not hard to root for, but, you know, whether or not we should be rooting for what this character is going through. And then the movie in the second half sort of wants to have it both ways. You know, it wants to sort of, you know, be the sort of the dramatic sort of arc of this character and her illness starting to overcome her a little bit. She just begins to alienate other people. It leads to, you know, some uncomfortable moments in the second half, and I don't think the movie is really capable of making that transition successfully, and the movie suffers because of it, and also then sort of calls into question what we had been sort of laughing at during the first hour. So I didn't dislike this movie entirely. Like I said, the first hour I think is enjoyable enough to recommend, but overall, I do have to come down on the downside on this one. Primarily, I just don't think it's capable of blending its genres in the way that the Skeleton Twins, for example, last year did so successfully. So down for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually really dislike this movie. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think Kristen Wiig does the best that she can with what she's given here, but I don't think she's given much. I think it's a really bad script, and I think it's really poorly directed. And, you know, Shira Piven is from Chicago, and, you know, I met her, I know her, but, man, this is a really poorly directed film. The second half of the movie, at that point, it's just, for me, it's just like, okay, I don't, you know, at that point, I had it. I was done with it. And I didn't really like any of the characters in it, except for Kristen Wiig, who I think was really, really trying. You know, the premise of it just you know, she watches VHS tapes of Oprah that she's memorized over and over again and then gets her own talk show and just cuts checks. None of it really works. The relationships don't really work. I didn't think it was particularly amusing or funny, even in the first part of the movie, you know, and I know that, like, as the film goes on, it's not supposed to be funny because of her condition and what she goes through. But overall, I just thought it's just not a good film. Not a fan. It's out now where is it playing? I watched it on the on-demand.
So. I think it's at the Music Box. There was a screening last night at the Music Box. I don't know if it's playing there all week.
Okay. So there was, you know, that's right. It is at the Music Box because Shira Piven was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she accompanied the screening on that. So, yeah, so it's at the Music Box, and it's also on the on-demand, and that's how I watched it. Okay. All right, cool. All right, very quickly, Eric, last one, Far From the Maddening Crowd.
Yeah, okay, well, this is the fourth adaptation of the Thomas Hardy novel, one of those being a television adaptation.
I just remember the one with Julie Christie that's like 10 hours long.
Yeah, that's the John Schlesinger version.
Right. That's
there's
right.
one. I had to look this up myself, so don't feel bad. But there's one from 1915. I guess. So clearly this is an old book. There was a television adaptation a year after the Schlesinger version.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the Julie Christie version is obviously the most well-known of the bunch. And this one stars Carey Mulligan in the role that Christie played, Bathsheba Everdeen, who is kind of your very just an independent woman, living off the land, she's a woman that inspires a lot of interest in her beauty and her headstrongness. The first of which is a sheep farmer, this time played by Matthias Schoenaars, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Okay.
A sheep farmer who takes an instant liking to her and immediately professes marriage to her, and she, of course, turns him down. Then the years progress, she ends up her livelihood enhances over time, and she attracts even more suitors, including another wealthy gentleman played by Michael Sheen.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Michael Sheen, who is completely smitten with her and immediately proposes marriage to her, and she turns him down. There's another suitor, a soldier played by Tom Sturridge, who sort of arouses her passions finally by, you know, doing foreplay with swordplay, if you will.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically what you have here is basically there's something about Mary of its time. And you have a film that, you know, or a story that is, you know, you really have to sort of buy into the fact that these guys are going to just fall head over heels for this character for one reason or another. And Carey Mulligan, of obviously a very charming screen presence and a very lovely lady. When you're watching the film and you sort of see them, especially the first two guys, sort of just immediately propose marriage to this woman, you kind of sit there and like go, why? And that's really sort of a fault of the storytelling and Carey Mulligan not exactly fitting into this role, this character that we believe is going to inspire this kind of sort of instantaneous passion and longing for. We don't really get why people are interested in her. She's not that interesting a character, other than the fact that she seems to be the only woman around these guys at the time. I guess the options are limited, so you just propose marriage to whoever's there. It's a film that doesn't really just inspire passion at in the slightest, really. It's a very dull film that doesn't really live up to this sort of this grand romantic feeling that story obviously wants to invoke. The main guy, played by Schoenaerts, is really just kind of a boring drip. I mean, I know he's supposed to be sort of the handsome, stoic, you know, sheep farmer dude, but it just, it never, you know, he sounds as dull as he actually is. I think that the only character in the movie that sort of inspires any sort of empathy whatsoever is Michael Sheen's character, who I think has a different take on it than, I forget, was it Alan Bates that played him in the,
yeah,
in the Christie version? Yeah.
Yep.
Plays him much differently than Bates did in that movie. And I think, his character is believable. You understand where he's coming from and why he would, why he's willing to do all this for this woman. And then the Sturridge, the soldier character, is played way just over the top, is just the third lout that, is just, the clearly the wrong guy that she immediately falls for. And at that point, the hell with her, as far as I'm concerned. Always choosing the wrong person. But no, this is a film that is just kind of lays there on the screen. And I hope that's not what happens to these guys on their wedding night. But
hello.
That's what this movie sort of feels like. It feels like a really bad, boring honeymoon, and the marriage just goes on forever.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Far from the maddening crowd. All right. Colin, what do we got next week?
we only spent two segments talking about it. What else is there to say? Oh, Pitch Perfect and Mad Max. It's funny. They're screening on Tuesday. I know we're talking shop here, but 4:15, Mad Max. 7 o'clock, Pitch Perfect 2. You really got to reverse those.
Yeah, man.
Really?
You do. Yeah, you do. Now here's the problem. I'm on vacation next week, so we won't be able to. We won't be able to review it. But that might be good because my head is probably going to explode.
Yeah, you might not be here for a reason.
Well, yeah. I'm actually on vacation starting next week, so we won't be able to review Mad Max and Pitch Perfect 2, which are two movies that I'm actually looking forward to. Well, obviously, I'm kind of looking forward to the Mad Max movie, just a little.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little.
Yeah, but if people want to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, I'm sure that, we will be expressing our thoughts.
Absolutely,
there.
Yes. So sure. Check that out there. You can check out Facebook.com/NickDShow and all that cool stuff. Colin, Eric, thank you guys so much. And congratulations on another successful Chicago Critics Film Festival.
Thank you, man. I appreciate
that. Really cool stuff. All right, you guys, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. We got a week off next week because I'm taking a vacation. So it's just weird that I'm going to not be able to review the Mad Max movie next week. But I'm sure that you'll actually, if you listen closely, if you open your windows and listen closely, I believe you'll be able to hear my reaction to the Mad Max movie Friday afternoon.